The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. And straight ahead on the program, we'll look towards next week's Fed meeting and its monetary policy going forward. I'm Tom Busby in New York.
I'm Caroline Hepke in London, where we're looking ahead to the UK's rate decision.
I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. I'll take a look at the upcoming results from China's Tencent Holdings and whether a little less regulation is producing dividends.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 991 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, DAB Digital Radio London, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Tom Busby, and we begin today's program with the Federal Reserve. This coming week, the Fed hosts a two-day meeting on interest rates and monetary policy with a decision out on Wednesday. Will the Fed leave its benchmark lending rate unchanged for the fifth meeting in a row? And if so, why? Now for more, we're joined by Michael McKee. He's Bloomberg's international economics and policy correspondent. So, Michael, what do you expect to see happen this week, and what do you see in the Fed's dot plot forecast?
Well, that's the right way to look at it, because the Fed's not going to do anything in terms of its policy rate. It'll leave it where it is, range of 5.25%, 5.5%, because they basically told us that for the last 3 weeks, and they're not going to go back on that and surprise the markets. They also are looking for more data. But the dot plot is going to be the interesting one, along with the summary of economic projections, because are they going to raise their projection for inflation, and how would that affect their view of rate cuts this year? Since the last Fed meeting on January 31st, we have seen CPI inflation and PPI inflation come in stronger than expected. And so the question is, do we think that this is the new trend, that we're going to be stuck with inflation that is stickier and harder to bring down than the Fed anticipated? Or do they think this is kind of one-off seasonal adjustment around the first of the year? That's going to be the real question.
Now, but in fairness, June of 2022, inflation 9.1%. Just last week, we saw it down to 3.2%. So it has accelerated a little bit from the months prior, and we've still got a long way to go to its 2% target. But it is still sort of trending the right way.
Well, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. If Jay Powell were running for president, he could tout going from 9 to 3. But since he's got to get it down to the 2% target, the fact that it's going the wrong way now is not necessarily good news for them. And that will influence their views. If they think that we are going to see a stickier kind of inflation, then that might lead them to change the dot plot. The dot plot that came out in December, the last time they did one, suggested 3 rate cuts this year. Between the meetings, we've had several Fed officials suggest that if inflation proves to be a problem, that maybe there will be fewer. It would only take 2 to move their dots up to change the consensus forecast. So we're going to be watching that very closely.
Now, a few weeks ago, in testimony to Congress, Fed Chair Jerome Powell did say he thinks rates are at their peak right now, 23-year high, and it would, quote, likely be appropriate to begin dialing back policy at some point this year. So that follows.
Yeah, and asked about what it would take to do that, he basically said, we need continued good news on inflation. He said, we didn't need to have it be better each month, go down significantly each month as it did during most of 2023, but it had to be going in the right direction. And right now, it's not going in the right direction. So I imagine we will get a caution from him that even if they don't change the dot plot, that they are aware and watching inflation right now, and that if they needed to do something, they would. I don't think that rate increases are on the table right now, but cutting back on the number of rate cuts or pushing them back later in the year is certainly a possibility.
Now, inflation, obviously the headline measure, but there's also job creation, which has been unexpectedly robust. Housing and retail sales a little uneven here and there, sometimes up, sometimes down. So is it job creation that really has the Fed optimistic about the economy?
It is. And also the idea that companies are spending money, you know, a little more than they had been as they get perhaps some of the federal government's fiscal assistance in the Infrastructure Act and the CHIPS Act. There is a concern that maybe the economy gets too hot, but it's not proving out. We're seeing strong job creation. We're seeing weak jobless claims. They went down again this last week, but we are not seeing strong retail sales at this point. Now, retail sales are pretty much only goods, and so we'll have to wait till the end of the month after the Fed meeting to see whether people are spending on services and how strong consumer spending overall is. But it doesn't suggest that the consumer spending, which is two-thirds of the economy, is benefiting from any of this yet.
Now, in housing, we've seen rates this past week go down below 7%. If there was ever a time of the year, right now, March, April, May, when we're going to see housing accelerate a little bit, this is it. So I imagine that is being very closely watched as well.
It's being closely watched, but the general feeling is that people really won't come out to buy houses until you get mortgage rates down close to 4%. It's going to be a while until we get there. They aren't going to come down to where they were. You're not going to get a 3% mortgage anymore, but you might get one between 4 and 5 if inflation continues to fall. And that's what we have to watch. There isn't expectation that we're going to see a gangbusters housing market this spring, even though it is the time of year when you normally do.
Well, our thanks to Michael McKee, Bloomberg International Economics and Policy Correspondent. Now we move next to the athletic footwear and apparel giant Nike. The Dow Component reporting third quarter results this coming Thursday. Many analysts are wondering whether economic headwinds in China will impact the company's sales. And for more, we're joined by Poonam Goyal, senior U.S. e-commerce and retail analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. Poonam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what are you expecting to see from the sneaker and sportswear giant, and how big a role will sales in China play into that?
Sure. The fiscal third quarter, which is largely in line with the fourth quarter for most other retailers for Nike, we expect sales to fall slightly. That's largely a function of just lackluster consumer demand, largely on the apparel side, I would say, not as much on the footwear side. And where we're seeing weakness is across the board, really. We're expecting EMEA to be weak. It's expected to be down low single digits, North America as well. And these two markets collectively are the largest markets for Nike. That said, China is important. And you know, you asked how important is it? China's about 15% of their sales. And we're only expecting to see a low single digit gain, about 2% in China. So that's not as robust as you would have expected earlier last year when, you know, China had ended its zero COVID policy. So things are a little murky, but I would say that that's all near term. I do think that Nike still remains a solid brand, $50 billion plus in sales, the largest sportswear brand in the world. And we don't think its position is at risk at all.
Well, let's talk about Nike's initiative on direct-to-consumer sales. Has it made a material impact, and has it affected some of the retailers that it supplies?
So Nike had, a few years ago, made a big push towards DTC, you know, pulling out a lot of key wholesale accounts, including moderating its exposure to some of the department stores as well as Foot Locker. We saw that flip on its heels last year, right? When they said that they're going back into Foot Locker in a more strategic way, they're also entering DSW and they're pushing more so in wholesale. Now, what does this mean, right? You know, DTC has higher margins, and therefore when they had announced this move a few years back, it was good for margin. And now as they're pulling away, I wouldn't say they're pulling away from DTC, but I would say they're leaning more into wholesale. The margins do have a headwind from that mix shift kind of flip-flopping. But I would say wholesale is important. Their partnership with Foot Locker is important because if you live in the suburbs of New Jersey like I do, it's hard to get to a Nike store, right? The flagship store in New York City is great, but it's 2 hours to get there. So where do you buy good Nike product. The outlets have usually, you know, product that came out maybe a year ago or 6 months ago or stuff that's left over. And the only place really that you can find compelling Nike product in a suburb is at Dick's Sporting Goods. So coming back to some of these wholesale accounts, I think is a good move for Nike, as it will make it be available to all of America again.
Now, to that point, you've written about Nike finally getting control of its pandemic era inventory and supply chain problems. Are things back where they should be? And is it supplying all this new product for consumers?
I think supply is back and where it should be. So we don't foresee any supply chain disruptions at Nike this year. In terms of supply within the marketplace, I think that's a little mixed. There are still excess inventories in the wholesale channels. So in North America specifically, we do think that that headwind will persist at least through the first half of this calendar year or for Nike's fiscal fourth quarter. But around the world, as inventories are stabilized and as supply chains are operating at, I would say, near normal levels, we do think that there are tailwinds from this to be had in the second half of the calendar year 2024.
And Nike is already the biggest women's athletic apparel and shoe brand. So are they banking a lot of growth on women customers?
Yeah, so women's is actually a very, very important category, not just for Nike, but really for all the athleisure brands. It's a growing category, and Nike does have a lead there. But I would say when you look at women's versus total sports, where the lead that Nike has, the gap between that is very different. So Nike is by far the largest sportswear brand, and it has a large lead to its competitors. But when you look at women's, the lead isn't as wide, right? So to me, the women's playing field is anyone's game. So Nike is a leader today, but that doesn't mean that it will stay a leader forever if others also step up their efforts, because they don't have a wide margin lead versus the rest of the competition.
And how is it compared to like Lululemon, which, you know, here in New York, you see on all over, all women wearing everything by Lululemon, also some Athleta, that's the Gap brand. Is Nike moving into those types of products, the yoga pants, the stuff you wear to the supermarket or wherever?
They are. So the push for lifestyle athletic wear has been something that most athleisure brands, including Nike, have been going after. It's a little different of a customer still. You know, we think where Lululemon shines is that it understands the woman customer probably better than any of the other brands, because that is where they shine. They have the right fit. They have the right material. They have the right function. They know how it works and they understand it. Nike has performance built into its women's wear, but I don't know if it has the fashion right. Not to say that it's wrong, but I think it leans more towards performance versus where you have a Lululemon yoga pant. It's performance and fashion.
Yes.
So I think that intersection is where Nike is trying to go to as well with women's, but I think that will take time. It's not something that they can do overnight.
Well, we're going to find out a lot more on Thursday. Well, our thanks to Poonam Goyal. She's senior U.S. e-commerce and retail analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, a big decision this week on interest rates from the Bank of England. I'm Tom Busby, and this is Bloomberg.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds.
And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Tom Busby in New York. Up later in our program, earnings from one of China's biggest names in technology and a look ahead to the next move from Australia's central bank. But first, with UK interest rates at historic highs, pressure is mounting on the Bank of England. While recent economic data suggests the economy may be moving in the right direction, one wrong move could undo all the progress made to date. The situation makes for a difficult choice for central bank policymakers who will vote where to move rates in the coming days. And for more, let's go to London and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchor Caroline Hepker.
Tom, the last time we heard from the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey, he told us that when it comes to cutting interest rates in the UK, it's a question of when, not if.
I think we've now changed the question, really, from how restrictive do we need to be to for how long do we need to be restrictive. That's important. We've also taken the upside bias off. We have included a risk, by the way, a new risk, actually, which is really reflecting, obviously, sort of tragic events in the Middle East and the impact that can have through the Red Sea effects. So I think now the question is for us is really is for how long do we need to maintain this stance going forwards? You know, I've said a number of times, we're not making predictions at this point. We're setting up the framework. The things that we think are important to look at really haven't changed, actually. So services inflation, aspects of the labour market, you know, the domestic drivers of inflation.
That was Andrew Bailey speaking to Bloomberg Television after the last rates decision. Now, in the meantime, recent economic data signals really a step in the right direction. The Bank of England having emphasised its data-driven approach. The UK economy rebounded in January after falling into a technical recession in the second half of last year. In addition to that, Britain's jobs market, which fuelled inflationary pay rises immediately after the pandemic, does seem to be cooling and cooling pretty sharply, with the first increase in unemployment since July. Despite those signs, though, the recent communication has suggested that the Bank of England is really in no hurry to ease policy, and signs of a rebound give it cover to wait a little bit longer for confirmation that inflation is on course for the durable return to the 2% target. Now, Northern Trust chief economist Carl Tannenbaum has told us that the Bank of England does now have a difficult choice to make.
I think it's the most complicated of the big three. Even the Bank of Japan, which will meet later this month, is right pleased with what they're seeing on their inflation numbers. And most of us think that rates will be in positive territory before long. But the Bank of England, certainly the last Monetary Policy Committee, was the first that I can ever remember that had votes for a hike, votes to remain stable, and votes to cut, signifying that within the group there is a lot of disagreement over the diagnosis of inflation. And I can understand why, given the conflicting signals that we're getting from labor markets.
How would you characterize the state of the UK economy now?
Standstill at best, I would say. The quarterlies have barely been positive, in fact, slight negative, I believe. And certainly the momentum that we're seeing in the United States is not present here in Europe. Part of that is attributable to the massive amount of fiscal spending that has been done still in the United States, even past the pandemic. That is an option that has not been available to Europe, where budget constraints, certainly that surround Jeremy Hunt's budget proposal, illustrate how hard it will be to achieve any kind of fiscal expansion in Europe.
That was the chief economist at Northern Trust, Carl Tannenbaum, speaking to me on Bloomberg Radio. It's also worth considering how the decisions of international central banks will affect the policymakers here in the UK. So recently, the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said that it is unlikely that market interest rates will return to levels that prevailed before the COVID-19 pandemic. Bloomberg's chief UK economist Dan Hansen tells me that the UK could see a sustained raft of rate cuts to come, but probably not at the next meeting.
Yeah, I mean, I think this one's going to be a relatively dare say it, boring meeting, in the sense that no one's expecting any action. There was quite a big shift, I think, between November, December, and then to February. You know, the bank dropped its tightening bias. We got a vote for a cut. So we've had quite a big shift. And now they've made it very clear. I mean, you mentioned there the communication. They've made it very clear that they're pretty patient about the timing of the first rate cut, and they're looking to the data. And I think that that will continue to be the story at this meeting, that they're just waiting for more information.
Yeah, we saw that three-way split, quite unusual, didn't we? A Bank of England, Hawks, Doves, and some in the middle. Is that likely to return in future meetings? How much do you think that these individuals are going to coalesce around the decision-making?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that's the thing to watch at this meeting. So remember back in February, we had two for a hike. So Catherine Mann and Jonathan Haskell, one for a cut, Swati Dhingra, and the rest went for a hold. We thought in February Jonathan Haskell would go for a hold. I think with what's happened to the pay data, there's a chance that he'll move to a hold. He's been very focused on the labour market. We get a CPI print the day before the decision. That'll be very important, particularly what happens to services inflation. Mm. So our base case for the meeting is that he does go for a hold. So we get a slight shift in the makeup of the vote split. But to sort of answer your question directly, there will still be this three-way split where you've got Catherine Mann going for a hike, seven of them going for a hold, and Swati Dhingra continuing to call for a cut.
I mean, the labour market and the wage data is so important. The ECB has said similar also. The labour market in the UK does seem to be cooling. We notice, for example, redundancies have started to tick up, okay, from a low base, but they have. But the wage pressure is still there. There's still, you know, some sizable wage gains being offered.
Yeah, there are. And that's the combination of that and services inflation are the two things that they're just looking for information on and some more to gain the confidence to cut. I actually think looking at the wage data that we had, the most recent wage data, it came in pretty weak, actually, on an underlying basis. I know on a headline basis we're still up at 6%, which is way too high for the Bank of England to tolerate. But actually, if you look at sort of underlying measures of pay and more timely measures of pay within that data set, things are cooling off pretty quickly. And I think we're heading for an undershoot on the bank's February forecast on private sector regular pay, quite a big undershoot. The big risk on the horizon is the hike in the national minimum wage.
Mm. That's comes coming in April,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that will be something that they're going to be focused on. I think they're going to want to see data on that before they go ahead and cut. So, but I think the news on pay has been actually since the start of the year, and on inflation generally, has been pretty good. Things are tracking their forecast, if anything, coming in slightly below it. So that's good news.
Mm. In terms of cuts then for the rest of the year, you know, we're pricing in less for the Bank of England than for other major central banks. Do you think that holds this year, that view?
So we have a slightly different view on all of this. I think one interesting thing with market pricing is that you have to remember it's a mean or an average. So that could potentially be reflecting two scenarios, one where they don't cut at all and one where they actually cut quite a lot. And actually, we're in that second camp. So we're of the view that once they start, at least for a time, they'll cut once a meeting. They'll probably get the base rate down to about 4%, and then they'll take stock. Because the question really with this easing cycle is, where's neutral? Like, where is the sort of long-term level where rates will settle? And there's obviously an enormous amount of uncertainty about that. But I think the reason why they will be able to go one a meeting, one of the big reasons they'll be able to go one a meeting, is that in the second half of, or from the spring and into the second half of the year, inflation's likely to be below 2% because of what we're going to see with energy prices. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's going to be core inflation still going to be around 3%, but I think the sort of risk to inflation expectations has gone. Bailey sort of hinted at that in his recent comments, that they're less worried about second round effects.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a case of taking away some of that restrictiveness. And in our view, even if you're at 4%, the monetary policy would still be weighing on the economy. It would still be restrictive. So I think there is a case for bringing rates down relatively quickly and then taking stock.
Yeah. It was interesting. I mean, that's sort of reflected in what Janet Yellen, the US Treasury Secretary, has been talking about in recent days, you know, that we would be unlikely to return to pre-pandemic levels in terms of yields, US Treasury yields in the 2010s on average 2.39%, but we're not likely to get back to that. But interesting that you say, you know, for 5.25 to come down to 4 is the expectation. Do you think that the Bank of England will be influenced decisively by the Federal Reserve? I mean, history surely would say yes.
I don't know about that. So I think the market perception is that the Fed leads the way. In this inflation cycle, you can see why that would be the case, because inflation's about 6 months ahead in the US. The sort of the disinflationary process is about 6 months ahead. The challenge to it, I guess, would be what happened at the end of 2021, where the bank started its hiking cycle and the Fed didn't start until early 2022. Mm. So it's not completely bound by the Fed. I mean, it can't completely disconnect purely because of the sort of what might happen to the exchange rate as a result. But I think the economic picture, the sort of growth picture, is very different in the UK. And as I say, there's going to be this story around below 2% inflation here. Granted, it's as a result of energy prices, but nonetheless, that changes the picture dramatically. And I think the other thing to play in, you've got the Fed on one side, you've got the political picture, the domestic political picture on the other, and the noise is coming from MPs. If inflation's below 2% and the Bank of England isn't seen to be sort of doing something about that and responding to it, the pressure's going to mount, I think.
Yeah, general election expected in the coming months, of course. Do you think that it could be good news for UK equities if we get rate cuts of the magnitude that you've talked about?
I mean, I would differentiate between cyclical and structural here. So when you cut rates, it's a cyclical boost to the economy. And I guess it goes to the problem why UK equities have underperformed. Even if it's 100 basis points of rate cuts, 200 basis points of rate cuts, are we going to get a cyclical boost to the economy? Does that change the underlying structural picture of weak productivity growth? No. So I don't think it's going to be a long-term boost to the equity picture, no.
That was Bloomberg's chief UK economist Dan Hansen discussing the path ahead for UK rates as we await the 21st of March Bank of England decision. I'm Caroline Hepke here in London. You can catch us every weekday morning for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 5 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Tom.
Thank you, Caroline. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, what could be a big move from Australia's central bank this week and earnings from one of China's biggest tech companies. I'm Tom Busby, and this is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm Tom Busby in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. The Reserve Bank of Australia is set to announce its next decision on interest rates. We'll have more shortly with Doug Krisner. But first, let's head to Hong Kong and Brian Curtis.
Tom, we look ahead to earnings from Tencent Holdings. It might be a little early, but we want to see if a little less scrutiny on the regulatory front might grease the wheels a bit for Tencent. In China, the NPC approved a 10% increase in the budget for science and technology, and policymakers are desperate to unleash what's referred to as quality productive forces. Bloomberg Intelligence says that Tencent should be able to increase revenues by double digits in 2024. To talk a little bit about the earnings, we're joined by Robert Lee, Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst. Thanks very much, Robert, for being with us. So Tencent's third quarter revenue was $21.5 billion, and that was up 10% year over year. Let's start off with this. What are you expecting on revenue and profit in this latest reporting period?
So I don't expect any major surprises from the results when we hear them next week. The company should have experienced a solid rebound driven by the reopening of China's economy, with earnings increasing in the 30% plus range. So, they're set to report strong figures, but clearly the stock market's always looking ahead into this year. And as you already said in your introduction, whilst the growth is likely to normalize this year, this is a company that's still capable of delivering solid double-digit free cash flow growth for the next 3 years at least.
So you're more constructive, obviously, on the company now than you have been over the past year. What's at the center of that?
When we launched coverage on Tencent approximately a year ago, I think there were very high expectations driven by the optimism that came with the reopening of China's economy. And there was a view out there in the market that the company would be back to business as usual. We didn't believe that view. And core thesis focused on some medium-term structural headwinds that the company's likely to experience. So we maintain that view. But since we launched coverage on them close to a year ago, the stock price has substantially underperformed. I mean, it's down over 30% in absolute terms. And also, there's been a rebalancing of expectations in the market, and I think the market is taking a more realistic view as to what level of growth this company can realistically deliver over, as I said, the next few years. So to expect this company to deliver double-digit cash growth in the low to mid-teen range is totally appropriate, and I think there's now, things are more imbalanced, which is why we recently added it to our focus list as an idea.
I mentioned a possible lighter touch from regulators that might be coming. What are you hearing on that level?
Okay, I think on that, again, winding the clock back to 2-3 years ago, China's tech sector is dominated by these two internet goliaths, so Tencent and Alibaba, which have been arguably become too powerful. I mean, they had fingers in a lot of pies. They dominated a lot of industries with allegations that they potentially abused their power in some way, trying to shut out competition or whatever. So I think a lot of regulation that we've seen come through in the last couple of years has been trying to level the playing field. That's one thing. I think the second focus of the regulator has been to protect the more vulnerable in society, particularly children, etc. So all of that has now worked through, and I think we're entering a period of more stability on the regulatory front, and particularly given the economic challenges that China faces, I think the Chinese government has now come to realize that actually we need the support of these two companies, and they're core to the future direction of the tech sector and major drivers of economic growth. So I think we've seen a more constructive tone from central government and expect that to continue over the next few years.
What have we seen with game approvals by the authorities? And also, how tough are the curbs that are in place on trying to monetize from within inside these games?
We've seen a normalization of the game approvals, having previously experienced a couple of hiatus where the approvals completely stopped. So we're now back to a run rate of around 100 or so approvals a month, which is still well down on where we were 2 or 3 years ago. But as I said, I think we've hit a steady state on that front. Tencent and its closest competitor, NetEase, are picking up a reasonable number of approvals, which helps give you some confidence that this business can again achieve double-digit earnings growth over the next few years. Now, again, that does not match the strong 20-30% growth they delivered 2-3 years ago. And again, sort of tying in with the structural headwinds that I hinted at a few minutes ago, I think the business is entering a period of slower growth, But still, I don't think there's any major concern with a business that can grow double digit. So I think, you know, we're seeing more stability on that front.
Most companies are somewhat reliant on the general levels of growth in the country in which they operate. With Tencent, it has so many irons in the fire, from cloud computing to gaming to fintech. I'm kind of curious, when we look at the total pie, does Tencent move and groove more on how the economy is doing, or do they have enough separate drivers that they can, if they're relatively left alone by the regulators, that they can make money even during difficult times? How do you see that balance?
That's a great question. I mean, first observation is, whilst again, people often mention Alibaba and Tencent in the same breath, they're very different businesses. Alibaba is far more focused on the e-commerce side, which is a smaller element within Tencent. So I think relative to Alibaba and some of the e-commerce peers who are suffering from heightened competition from low-cost new entrants, that's not an issue for Tencent. It's a far more diversified business with that benefits from stronger technical barriers to entry in its core markets. So it's a much better, more diversified story. It is still tied to economic growth, but again, if you look at their fintech business and you look at their Weixin or WeChat super app, I mean, this is a ubiquitous part of life in China. If you look at the process, their everyday payments, so buying coffees, buying taxis, you know, eating out restaurants. So it's a sort of everyday spend, which is still sensitive to the overall economic outlook to some degree, but I would argue is less sensitive than the pure e-commerce plays who are more dependent on larger purchases, which are things that people could cut back on if they're looking to tighten their belts.
Robert, thank you. Robert Lee, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Analyst. Now let's get to Doug Krisner.
Thanks, Brian. Australia's central bank will be meeting in the week ahead, and policymakers down under will consider whether now is the time to begin lowering interest rates. Let's preview the meeting with Bloomberg's James McIntyre, our economist covering Australia and New Zealand. I'm wondering, James, whether now is the time to talk about a rate cut, or maybe it's too soon.
Well, in our view, we think it's too soon. So the RBA has received some data that they've liked over since their February meeting. We're on the new 8 meetings a year, no longer monthly meeting schedule for the RBA. So our next meeting won't come before May. And they've had GDP data, CPI data. They've said in comments that they've been broadly in line with what they were expecting and what their February forecast suggested. So there's likely to be nothing that's really going to give them any kind of burning platform or push them to do anything other than stay on hold at this meeting.
Here in the US, one of the debates that we're having is whether or not there is a risk that the Fed may need to remain higher for longer because inflation is just too sticky, too stubborn. Is there the same risk in Australia?
There has been that concern, and in fact, some of the narrative that we've seen around the RBA is that because they were late to the party on hiking rates and haven't lifted as much as the Fed, that they might be slow to begin easing as well, or might be one of the laggards when the easing cycle eventually arises. Our view on that is that this pain that is actually, you know, much, much more effective when it comes to monetary policy within the Australian economy is something that means that, well, even though the RBA might be seeing inflation that they're not quite comfortable with, they know that the damage that's being done to households is extreme enough that we'll be guaranteeing inflation will be going where it wants to. There's nothing like a pretty weak demand environment to mean that some of that stickiness inflation actually becomes a lot less sticky and some of those price rises or increases erode a little bit faster than some are expecting. We think that's where the economy is likely to go down under over the coming months.
So we've talked about the mortgage market, touched on households. How are businesses feeling right now, and what's showing up when you look at the labor market?
Well, business confidence, it's okay. Some of the conditions are soft. We did get a reading from businesses about their investment plans, and they are actually indicating that things are very, very strong, quite good, especially in the non-mining sector, which is something that the RBA has been wanting to see for close to a decade now, since the previous mining boom peaked back in 2012, 2013, looking for those non-mining firms to step up. A population boom has seen them step up, But we are still at this point where I think that even though things are looking good, you can still have a good old-fashioned demand downturn that could see those businesses decide that a prospective investment plan might not make sense. And if they all pull back en masse with the economy looking potentially a bit weaker than many might have suggested, that's a scenario the RBA could create by staying too high for too long, and it's one that we think that they'll want to avoid. And that's why we think that some of that softening on rates will come through, maybe not this month, but definitely when we see them meet again later in May.
Well, that was my next question. If you could kind of lay out the pivoting, let's accept your notion right now and the notion that Bloomberg Economics is operating under, which is that the cash rate will be held steady at 4.35% in the coming week. When it's time to pivot, can we talk about magnitude and trajectory? What might that look like?
Look, it really depends how the economy is shaping up, right? We could have a scenario where if there is some sort of shock that comes out of left field, obviously not our base case, then we could see the RBA move quite sharply. That's what they've done before, even with inflation outcomes in the rearview mirror remaining quite high. They still cut and cut aggressively. But let's talk about not the kind of hypothetical risk case, but what is more of our base case scenario? Well, we see the RBA beginning to deliver a more gradual 25 basis points, maybe once a quarter hikes cuts, I should say, as the easing cycle goes through. So we think that could begin in May. However, the next sort of set of opportunities we think would then be if they decide to stay on hold in May and see what's going on through the middle of the year in Australia, that around about August could be the next opportunity. That February, May, August and November, they're those key meetings where the RBA does their big quarterly forecast reviews. And we think that once they do the review this time around, it could be enough to justify a cut. If not, we'll see that cut coming in August and a steady stream of ongoing 25 basis point cuts if there's no emergency situation suggesting that demand is really, really weak and they need to do a lot more and a lot more in a hurry.
Great insights. James, thanks for stopping by to help us set up the RBA meeting in the coming week. Bloomberg's James McIntyre, our economist covering Australia and New Zealand. I'm Doug Krisner. You can join Brian Curtis and myself weekdays here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 8 a.m. in Hong Kong, 8 p.m. on Wall Street. Tom?
Thank you, Doug. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 a.m. Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Tom Busby. Stay with us. Top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.